Better, faster, stronger AI development with Intel's Edge AI. Visit intel.com/edgeai to accelerate your AI app development with Intel's Edge AI resources. Access open source code snippets and guides for YOLO V8 and Pattern models to deploy seamlessly. Visit intel.com/edgeai now. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Stack Overflow podcast, a place to talk all things software and technology. Your hosts are here, Ben Popper and Ryan Donovan. We work on the content team at Stack Overflow, and we are in the thick of trying to learn all things Gen AI. It's a bit overwhelming out there. New research papers, new models, new modalities every day. So we are lucky today to have a great guest, Maxime Labonne. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. My French is pretty poor. He has been playing around with a lot of this stuff, building with a lot of this stuff, and also creating instructionals and kind of ways for other folks to get involved, I believe. So, Maxime, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. No worries, your French is terrific.
Merci. So tell us, Maxime, a little bit about yourself, how you got into the world of software and technology, what you do for a day job, and then, you know, kind of your passion, it seems, for what's going on in the world of ML.
Yeah, so I started this journey with AI during my PhD. I studied cybersecurity, and during my PhD, it was really like machine learning applied to cybersecurity. After that, I decided to continue and like expand my field a little bit. So not just about cybersecurity, but also about computer networks in general. That was at Airbus. And then I joined a team at JP Morgan that is more focused on large language models, because that was something I was really interested in. And that's also a reason why I made the switch.
Cool. Let's talk about some of the stuff you do in public. I found you through Twitter. You were sharing sort of resources that you were putting online for folks to learn themselves, you know, about how to train or work with or, you know, quantize or do various things with LLM. So can you tell us what some of the stuff you've been producing over the last couple of years or months, and who do you hope is out there interacting with this? Like, is this about contributing to the open source community, to knowledge? Is it about bringing in people to work on projects you're working on? What's it all about?
So I think that you're referring to the LLM course. It's a list of curated resources to get into LLMs. It's split into three different roadmaps. There's one about like the fundamentals, like what you need to know in terms of math and Python to get into this field. There's another one that is more focused on like the science behind building these large language models. And finally, there's one dedicated to engineering, which is more about rack pipelines and more about deployment. So it covers like pretty much all the major topics to get into this field. And other than that, I also do different kind of open source contributions. It can be tools that I make for myself, and then I'm like, oh yeah, it's really nice, so I'm going to release them for other people. And that's been quite popular. And also creating models using like fine-tuning techniques and more recently merges. That's also a big chunk of my activities now.
Nice. Yeah. Just looking at it, it looks pretty comprehensive, but I appreciate that you start immediately with the math of it, the linear algebra, the calculus. My first experience with neural nets was in college course, and it was just a sum function. And I had just taken calculus for poets and no linear algebra, so I had no idea how to comprehend it. How valuable would you say the math is to getting an understanding of LLMs?
I would say it's not that useful, actually, and I'm a bit bothered by the fact that it's like the first roadmap. I think people should know that if they struggle with something related to math, like here are the resources, but please do not start by like learning the math and then all the cool stuff, because otherwise I don't think that you'll be motivated enough to finish the course. So yeah, I don't think it's particularly useful, because you can build like write pipelines, you can deploy these models, you can do a lot of stuff with these models without requiring any math. Math is more for the researchy stuff. If you start reading research papers, this is where it becomes useful. But yeah, I would say avoid the math until you cannot avoid it anymore.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. We've been trying to run through sort of like a thought process. You're an organization that wants to bring in Gen AI. What are you going to do? Yeah. Well, are you going to create your own foundation model? You know, well, then you probably need some people who are experts in math, and you're going to have to learn how to do some pretty complicated stuff. It's also going to be expensive. You're going to need, you know, specialized people. You're going to need a ton of compute. You're going to need great data and a training run. you know, we don't have numbers, but we were on a phone call earlier this morning with somebody. Oh, a big training run for, you know, a heavyweight AI company could be $150 million. You know, that's, you know, not an investment you want to make as an experiment to see if Gen AI is going to be, you know, useful inside of your company. But then to your point, you know, there are other ways to go about it. You could go to, what was the company that was acquired by Databricks that builds models for people?
Mosaic ML.
Yeah, you could go to Mosaic ML and say, like, here's my AWS bucket. Can you, you know, take one of your great models or one of the ones I pick and do it for me? And they say they'll handle all of that plus the orchestration on the back end. Or you could, if you have a team of good ML data people, you know, internally, like you do, you know, read a couple of courses and, you know, get it going within a playground and see if it works. And then RAG is really the cheat code, right? It's like, you don't have to learn any of this stuff. Like, get your data organized, do some embedding in a vector database, maybe, and then just point it at the right API with some, you know, maybe prompt engineering that you've done around it, and you can get some pretty interesting results. I don't know. What do you think about that breakdown? Am I missing anything? Are there ways people should look at this in terms of how they want to bring it to the organization that you would say, I'm missing something important or you don't agree?
No, I think it's a really good overview. I would say that RAG pipeline is probably the first thing that you want to do, because you can basically use APIs that already exist, like GPT-4, and you do a bit of prompt engineering. You can like retrieve some information to add it to the context, and then it becomes better automatically. And then if you're serious about it, if you really want to build not just one model, but like the best model that you can, fine-tuning becomes really, really useful. Sometimes I see a lot of people saying like, oh, RAG is better than fine-tuning, or fine-tuning is better than RAG. But like in the end, we want to use both at the same time, because this is where you are going to maximize the performance.
Yeah, I've heard that the only reason why you'd pick RAG over fine-tuning or not use both is that if you want to forget things, right? Have you run into instances where somebody doesn't actually want to use RAG or shouldn't use RAG or shouldn't use fine-tuning?
Not really, to be honest. Like maybe you could not use fine-tuning if you really need GPT-4. In that case, it can be a bit tricky or very costly. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I would say like it's always a good idea, like no matter what you want to do. It's always better if you add more context to these models. So that's the RAG part. And it's always better if you retrain these models on the task that, or the domain that you want to apply them to. So it's a bit of a free lunch in terms of performance.
Right, right. And can you break down for me a little, like when you say fine tuning, what does that mean? We were talking to somebody the other day about this, and they said, you know, fine tuning versus pre-training, you know, there's like a whole sort of spectrum of it. And they were saying, maybe you just unfreeze one layer or blah, blah, blah. And I don't know what that means. Like when you say fine tuning and unfreeze a layer, what are we doing exactly?
Yeah. So the fine tuning aspect, it's important to mention, as you said, that it happens after the pre-training. So first you pre-train these models, and that's what you mentioned earlier, that it can be very, very costly because you need a lot of data and a lot of compute. And after this pre-training phase, you get a base model. So it can be Mistral 7B, it can be Llama 2, but this is a base model that has been trained to predict the next token in a sequence. It is not like ChatGPT where you interact with it and you can ask questions, it's going to answer your question. It's more like what you have on your phone, like the keyboard you have on your phone that can predict the next word you're going to input. So this is very important to understand, because the fine-tuning process allows you to go from this base model to fine-tuned chat model. And in fine-tuning, you have two main techniques. The first one is called supervised fine-tuning, where you're going to retrain your layers. You can freeze some of them because like they tend to be very redundant, and it's going to be like a lot more efficient if you do not retrain the entire model, but you retrain only the parts that matter. And to do this instruction fine-tuning, you'll have like an instruction data set with pairs of like instructions and answers. And when this is done, you can have like another layer of fine-tuning on top. It's called preference alignment. And the preference alignment thing, it's also called reinforcement learning from human feedback. And what it allows you to do is to give preferences to the model. So you give one instruction and two different answers. One is the preferred answer, and the other one is the answer that you do not want to see. And this is very useful if you want to censor the model so it doesn't talk about like how to right. make drugs, for example.
It's important for people to understand the most cutting edge AI out there is also Mechanical Turk, like was fine-tuned with people going in and say this, don't say that. And that's why ChatGPT is such a pleasant experience, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's really used quite a lot, and you always need like more data set, more and more data set to train these models. Right.
So I understand the reinforcement learning with human feedback completely, and I can understand the idea of saying like, okay, I want to unfreeze parts of the model and, you know, fine tune it with slightly different data or instructions. But when you say unfreeze a layer, like in my mind, a neural network, yeah, it's a, you know, this deep set of layers of different connections. How do you know which layer corresponds to which, you know, part of its understanding or reasoning or intelligence? Like, how do you know which ones to unfreeze and which ones to instruct?
Yeah, I think it's a bit experimental. Now we have like recipes and we know which one has the best. Like a few years ago, I would have said like, oh, just keep like the last layers, the most important ones. Now what we do is that in the transformer architecture, you have one block that is repeated over and over and over time. And in this block, you have like the self-attention mechanism, and you also have like traditional fit-forward networks. It turns out that these fit-forward networks, you want to freeze them, and you want to only retrain like very small matrices instead. It's a technique called LoRA. And these very small matrices, they're going to approximate like the full ranked matrices in your layers. And this technique allows you to be very, very efficient. And instead of retraining 100% of the parameters, you're only going to retrain about like 1% of them. So the cost goes down and it's also like a lot faster, and you do not lose that much accuracy doing that.
Hmm. And I've heard of a new trend of merging models. How does that work?
That's like an additional step. Like when you've done like your pre-training, your supervised fine-tuning, your reinforcement learning from human feedback, turns out you have like 500,000 models on the Hugging Face hub. What can you do with like such a variety, such diversity of models? An answer is like, oh, we can just take the parameters and merge them together. And people realize that it produces pretty good models, actually. By merging two or more models together, you can get like better performance.
This is like a Pokemon or something? You just like put two together and see what comes out, and like sometimes it's great?
Yeah, and it's a bit of alchemy right now, because we do not really have a principled approach of doing it. We just know that it works.
Oh, cool.
Is it just sort of like getting to a statistical mean with the training, or is there something else going on?
There are different techniques. So you can have something very simple, like averaging the parameters. So you really average the values because there's the same architecture. Like one thing that is important is that you're going to use like the same architecture, the same type of models. And you can do a linear interpolation between these values. Then a bit more evolved, you can do a spherical linear interpolation that is going to be a bit nicer and preserve some nice properties in the models. And then you have like more advanced techniques that are going to try to retrieve really the most important parameters in each model and combine those instead of combining everything. Yeah, it works really well in practice.
So I guess one of the things that it seems like we're evolving towards is taking the strength of, you know, an LLM, which is the ability to be creative, you know, Andre Karpathy called them dream machines, not search engines, and then adding that in a loop with other agents that have some kind of control net or, you know, more symbolic, structured, rule-based AI. And if you combine those two things before you deliver the output, you can deliver something that is often more accurate, still can be novel and generated on the fly by the LLM, but has been sort of fact-checked or critiqued through this chain of thought. What's your take on that trend, and how do these, you know, maybe to the degree that you can explain it to a layperson, if you were, you know, writing a guide to it, how do these other systems help to guide and shape and sort of critique and improve what an LLM does?
Yeah, there's a lot of research and a lot of interest in like the kind of process that you describe. I would call it like post-processing. Like you really have an answer. Mm-hmm. What do you do with this answer, basically? Mm-hmm. So a way of doing it is using the chain of thought you mentioned. Chain of thought is quite a basic idea. Like it's a complicated term to just say, let's think step by step to the model. And maybe provide some examples because we realize that the models perform better if you provide the kind of reasoning that you expecting from them. So that's one technique, just like good prompt engineering to be able to maximize your accuracy. And then you can do a lot of different things. You can do self-consistency checks. You can like get multiple answers and compare them. And maybe you have a voting system. So if you ask the model 1 + 1 = 2 and it answers 4 times 2 and once 3, you say, okay, like probably 2, right? So there's all this thing. And on top of that, you also have grammar sampling. So instead, you can constrain the tokens that the models is going to output. And one application, for example, is to play chess. I made a little chess tournament with LLMs, and instead of like letting them output anything, I constrain them so they can only play chess moves that are possible at this moment on
legal
the board.
Moves.
Yeah, legal moves. Yeah. Thank you.
You know, another thing that I'm curious about from your perspective is kind of like, what does it take to get this to a place where a user of this system would feel satisfied with it? We were on a call with someone from Pinecone who works, you know, on vector databases and understands this stuff really well, and was saying a lot of people are very excited about this. They maybe, you know, fine tune a model or they do some RAG work and they create an application and then they're disappointed because it doesn't feel as robust, you know, as ChatGPT. And, you know, like, I think that should be obvious on its face, but I guess the question that I sort of have, and Ryan just wrote a great little article for us about, like, you know, what is the smallest model you can build that still produces like useful output? You know, is it 7 billion and it does children's stories? Is it, you know, 7 billion, but it's been trained on Stack Overflow questions, so its coding ability is pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if you look at this and you wanted to bring this into your organization and you wanted it to be useful, would you say to them, first of all, you're not going to build this from scratch unless you're a Fortune 500 company. Let's start there. Maybe you're going to, you know, buy it off the shelf from somebody, right? Like, who can build this for you, but you still have to integrate it into your tech stack. You're going to use an open source model and fine tune it on your own data. You're going to build a RAG system. But realistically, how many months is that going to take? How many staff, you know, are going to have to work on this? How much money are you going to have to invest? And how much prompt engineering, you know, are you going to have to do so that when you finally, you know, move this from test to live, customers don't get to buy your car for $1, or, you know, I can't remember some of the other, you know, recent examples of things where it's just like, once these things get out into the wilds, you know, it's easy, very easy to find the edge cases and the flaws and the prompt hacks almost immediately, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it really depends on the use case and the money that you can put into it. The bigger the model, the better the results, basically. Right. I'm particularly interested in the 7 billion parameter models because I think this is where it starts to become really interesting. Plus, it's very cheap. You can do a lot of stuff with it for like less than $10. So it doesn't cost a lot of money to train, to run, or to evaluate. But if I have the budget, I would go for models like Mixtral, which is a mixture of experts, or like Llama 70B. And then indeed, I think the difficult part is not training. Training is quite easy. There are a lot of great tools to do it, like Axolotl. Evaluation can be a bit tricky, but once again, if you do it for like a precise purpose, you can probably design a good benchmark. The real pain point is data and to create like a high quality data set. And I think this is where you're going to spend the most time, or you should spend the most time, because data is really critical. And if it's not of the highest quality, the model will suffer from it.
Right. So on the data, with some of those smaller models, they had synthetic data. Like the Phi model was trained on synthetic textbooks generated by other models. And it seemed to work out pretty well. Do you think that, you know, at some point we're going to have LLMs all the way down, or is there a sort of drawback to, you know, just training on pure synthetic data?
Yeah, synthetic data is a really big trend. Hugging Face also released their own synthetic data set a few days ago. And I think that it's really promising. You have like great results training from synthetic data. I would say yes, like I'm a big believer in it. About the drawbacks, I don't know. There are also like some things that are a bit strange about it. For example, if you ask Phi2 who designed you, it's going to say it's OpenAI. But it's a model made by Microsoft, right? So
they're same difference.
Yeah. So it's a bit strange. And like Phi2, for example, when you evaluate it, you also get like weird results. And that might be due to the fact that it's been trained on synthetic data. Basically, it performs better on benchmarks than in real life, which is also like a bit sus. But these models are difficult to evaluate in general. And maybe this is just a way also for us to consider other benchmarks to capture its performance in a more accurate way.
Yeah, the benchmarking question seems to be a big one where there are the kind of standard human eval stuff. And then there's, is it functional? Does it pass unit tests? Does it make sense to a person? Like,
does it write unit tests? They could do that now, I heard too.
Yeah, yeah. Do the unit tests pass unit tests? But I wonder if there's some sort of converging to a sort of accepted standard for benchmarking.
Not at the moment, unfortunately. A lot of people are working on this problem. You have the OpenLLM leaderboard, which is kind of the gold standard of the open source community. Unfortunately, like a lot of models are contaminated, like a lot of data sets contain some kind of like test sets, right? So that's not good. Right. It's mostly truthful QA. So that's a tricky problem. And then you can realize that actually this is quite narrow. And you have other benchmarks like EmptyBench that try to capture the performance of the model in a multi-turn conversation, which is absolutely not captured by the other benchmarks. So maybe you have a great model to do math, but it cannot have a conversation properly. So right now, I would say try to diversify the benchmarks and see if your model performs well on all of them. Because if it only performs well on one benchmark, yeah, it's not going to be like a great model overall.
So I guess, you know, you mentioned data quality. That's something we care a lot about at Stack Overflow. It seems like we're in a lucky spot because we have two things. One, you know, the way the data is organized is almost in a Q&A format already, right? So like if you're going to be asking and getting an answer like, you know, that, and then it has this metadata, you know, it says like, well, this one was the most upvoted and you can look at this as like a signifier or something. It has a recency score and things of that nature. If you were, right, trying to bring in, let's say, all your company's proprietary data to work with a Gen AI system, and it was just documentation like a code base and a bunch of wikis and a bunch of FAQs, is there any way for the model to score and understand which of that data is accurate or up to date? Or that has to all be human labeled and annotated beforehand? Like if the model's going to train on all your internal data so that it can do great stuff on it, or even if you're going to do RAG with the internal data, like you're going to be pulling from that, how does it know of the data that it's looking at what's factual and what's up to date?
You can ask GPT-4 and magically solve this issue. But no, I see what you mean. It's particularly striking with Stack Overflow because it immediately produces like a high quality data set where you have like instructions and answers. In general, it's not like that. In general, indeed, people have wikis and they don't have instruction. They just have like a lot of text and they don't really know what to do with it. So one way of doing it is to continue the pre-training phase. So you try to predict the next word again. Otherwise, and you probably want to do that too, it's to reformulate the text from the wiki into questions and answers. And to do that, you're not going to do it manually. It's way too time consuming. So you're going to ask another LLM to do it for you. And then you can also post-process and evaluate these samples to make sure that they are of high quality. And to do that, you have a lot of different techniques that are available now. But yeah, you can, like, one very common one is just to ask GPT-4 to score your samples, which is not obvious because it's really bad at producing like numerical outputs. So you have to be a bit clever in the way you prompt it to say like, add 1 point if this is present, add 1 point if this is present. But it works pretty well as a heuristic.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
You know, I want to go back to the RAG stuff. I think one of the things I saw recently is that even with RAG, you can run into some issues where the data is contradictory or you have data that doesn't quite give a good final answer. Are there post-processing, extra processing layers you can add on top of RAG to sort of ensure that it gives a good answer rooted in data and doesn't give an answer if it doesn't have the answer?
Yeah, this is like there are a lot of different techniques that you can try to implement on top of it, or you can try to see if you do not retrieve any context that is, because when you retrieve context, you have like a similarity score to make sure that it's actually close to what you're asking. And maybe you can just set a threshold. And if the similarity score is too low, you don't have the right context. If you don't have the right context, either it's in the knowledge base of the LLM, or you can just say, hey, we could not retrieve the right context, but here's the answer, or maybe not output any answer. I think it really depends on the use case. And then you can try to post-process it to indeed and evaluate the quality of the answer of the LLM. Could be a way of doing it. And if you have users, it can also be really nice because you can ask them if the answer is correct or not. And you can build a preference data set that you can later use to fine-tune the model once again based on the user feedback.
Hmm. So Maxine, obviously, yeah, you know, you understand this stuff really well, even down to the math. You play with it and you build with it. What, in your opinion, is sort of like the next step towards, you know, like AGI, and to what degree does an LLM have, you know, artificial intelligence? Like, it's not just a stochastic parrot. It's not just guessing the next token. It can look at and reason over language in ways that are pretty impressive. It has emergent capabilities that, you know, it wasn't designed for, to play chess or do arithmetic. Like, that is artificial intelligence of some variety. And to what degree, I mean, I know there's lots of issues with the MMLU or whatever, but if it can be an expert in many, many, many areas where most humans are not that expert, you know, like, what am I missing here in terms of what it can and can't do compared to us?
Yeah, it's quite limited, right? There's a lot of things that it cannot do, and people like to focus on those to say that they're actually pretty dumb. I think it depends on how you look at the situation, because they're really useful. I use them every day, so I would be very sad if they did not exist anymore. That's one way of seeing it.
You think of them as intelligent assistants. They provide you with intelligence when you need it applied somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. You can interact with them in natural language. And that's something that still surprises me to this day, because it's still quite new, right? The other hand, like, there are a lot of tasks where they're quite bad, like math, for example, quite bad at math. I think that the transformer architecture that powers this system since 2017 might not be the best one. Especially if we were talking about AGI, it's probably not the right architecture to do it. It's just like one stepping stone. I'm really curious about the other architectures that we are going to design in the future that can replace this transformer architecture, because I think that there's a lot of things that can be done in this space, and that will probably make models a lot more efficient. You will not need to have like such big models to do the same task. And they'll be able to also scale better, because right now the scaling laws are pretty brutal. You can throw a lot of compute on the problem, but it's not going to improve the model that much.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's really interesting. I heard somebody discussing this the other day. We can't know what's really going on, but they were sort of saying, like, we know, you know, adding more tokens, the matrix multiplication, it's just a power law and it becomes very expensive. And then Google comes around and says, well, now actually we can do 10 million tokens. I mean, they're not saying how much compute and how much money they're spending on it, but they're saying the context window, you know, will be a million tokens or 10 million tokens, which seems like a total, you know, step function change from what we were talking about before. No? You're shaking your head.
It's a bit unfair, but there was a paper, I think it's from Berkeley, that was released a few days before Gemini and this claim. And they also had like a 1 million token in the context window. So actually, this is already, we already know how to do it. Uh-huh. It's not new. But there's a technique, it's called ring attention. And you have like a multi-step process to gradually increase the size of the context window.
Right.
So I think this is like a bag of tricks, and we learn new tricks all the time and we implement them.
Right.
And this makes the model a lot better over time.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was using that as an example of some kind of architectural evolution or improvement that's allowing us to suddenly have a model that can be a lot more capable and without, as people maybe thought, you know, some huge increase in cost, for example.
No, that's true. Like, we really learned to be a lot more efficient in a lot of things. Like, for example, the attention mechanism that is at the core of the transformer architecture used to be quadratic, and now it's linear thanks to a lot of different improvements. So it really shows that you can just bend the scaling laws quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. Very cool. All right. Well, I want to say thanks so much for coming on. As we do at the end of every episode, we want to shout out somebody from Stack Overflow who came on and contributed a little knowledge. Thanks to Nikhil, earned a lifeboat badge for saving a question with a great answer. How do I efficiently compare two sets in Python? Nikhil has the answer for you, and we've helped over 57,000 people. So appreciate it, Nikhil. As always, I am Ben Popper. I'm the director of content here at Stack Overflow. Find me on X at Ben Popper. If you want to come on the program or you got questions and suggestions, email us podcast@stackoverflow.com. And if you liked what you heard, leave us a rating and a review.
I'm Ryan Donovan. I edit the blog here at Stack Overflow. You can find the blog at stackoverflow.blog. And if you want to find me, you can go on X and look for R. Thor Donovan.
Thanks for having me here. If you want to know more about LLMs or curious about the topic, you can find me on Twitter at Maxime Lebon and also on LinkedIn at Maxime Lebon. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.